Alex Link is there, the top back. Some of you in PK got to meet her last night. She graduated in 07.
Eight.
You've literally got it wrong in 12 times.
I've got it wrong every time. So she's one of our, yeah, 10 years. Anyways, to introduce Travis, I'm kind of proud of Travis because he was a master's student here. But rather than me doing introductions, we're going to have Courtney do it, and this is kind of fun because Courtney and Travis did their undergrad program together and their master's. Okay, so, and those of you that have been here for master's programs, can you imagine having them both here at the same time? So, and we did. But anyways, I'm going to let Courtney talk and introduce Travis.
All right, so as Mark said, I met Travis when I was an undergrad. But before I get to that, Travis got offered academic scholarships at Harvard for his undergrad, and he said no, and then he chose University of Idaho, right, for track scholarships. You gotta be a D1 athlete, right? You gotta have a full ride for track. And then after a short tenure at University of Idaho, you know, in Travis's language, screw this, would be a little bit more colorful, I think. And that's, he moved to Salem, Oregon, and that's where I met him, was at Willamette. And back then, Travis's interests and pursuits were at least eclectic, if not something more diverse than that. Right, so I wasn't convinced that there weren't six Travises in the room, because everybody had a story about him. And I didn't know everyone else's Travis. Right, and so there's the Travis I knew was exercise science Travis. And then the girl I was dating was a biochem major, and Travis is apparently a biochem student also, like tutoring biochem students. And so there's biochem Travis. There's track star Travis, who's always being hospitalized for rhabdomyolysis. That gets famous in a hurry. And rhabdo Travis, because it has an assonance.
That's good. I'm surprised I haven't heard that more. That's good. Okay.
And then there's basketball Travis, who's of average height and can dunk with his elbows. Right? He had like a 50-inch vertical, who I've seen. And so I just, again, I was sure.
Yeah, I don't think Mark ever pay out on that bet? I don't think he ever paid out.
I was sure there were like six different Travises, and we were all just conflating them. It's kind of a common name-ish, right? We're all just conflating them into one impossible superhero. But then I met your Travis, and your Travis, and your Travis, and your Travis. It's all the same guy, right? It's this Travis. And then we came to Pacific together, and that's where I started to get to know his personality. One personality for six Travises, right? It's like the opposite of multiple personality disorder. And that one personality is fiercely ethical and really focused on the greater good and just ruthless in his determination. And as all ambition is, you're always met with scorn and hardship and oppression, right? It's just nobody likes the ambitious guy. And I haven't met anybody who is more determined and ambitious than Travis. So I imagine his course, his journey, is just fraught with undeserved hardship, right? So I will.
Some deserve.
Travis may tell you some of those stories, but I'll turn the stage over to all six Travises at once, right? So Captain Planet.
Well, I don't get nervous in front of rooms, but now I feel like, how am I supposed to follow that up? I'm just a guy. That was weird. First of all, I'm happy to be here. This is super cool for me. I want to talk to you guys about what I do, but I'm super pumped that it's a lot of students in the room, because I really want to have a conversation with you guys about not just where I'm at, but the journey, and you know, try to be able to talk to you guys through about how I ended up where I'm at, because as much as Courtney might have just lied to you about all these cool things about me, I was just a dude. I mean, what I've accomplished is still kind of surreal to me. Before I get into all that, let me just tell you a little bit about what I do. So when I left here, I went to UC San Diego to get my PhD. I originally was going to keep doing the phys route. I wanted to do muscle physiology. I was super fascinated with like the mechanisms of muscle atrophy, you know, trying to sustain muscle, you know, muscle mass to improve outcomes in, you know, cancer, HIV, you know, even just recovering from an injury. And there was a super awesome scientist physician at UCSD, Mike Hogan, who was doing this really great stuff. And so I kind of befriended him at some conferences. I think we were at San Diego's, like the Southwest ACSM and I harassed him after his presentation, and so he kind of, you know, kind of took me under his wing, and he helped me, you know, get into the BMS program up there, the biomedical science program. But it's an actually really cool thing that they do in the grad program up there. They, your first year, you come in and be like, I'm going to work on this, I'm going to work on these things, and they're like, yeah, you have no idea what you're talking about. So we're going to make you for a year not pick something, and you're going to spend a year going around to each unit. So neuro, cardio, phys, infectious disease, oncology, and you go and you listen to every single faculty and what they're researching, and you learn about what they're doing while you're still doing your kind of first year of coursework. And you can rotate in labs for, like, you know, short periods of time, like 6 to 12 or 15 weeks, but they don't let you pick. It's all about trying to get exposure. And it was fascinating because I started out, you know, not really having like a very firm grasp. I crushed it on the phys side. I mean, but I'm going to school with people who had like masters in genetic development and molecular biology and developmental epidemiological neuro, just crazy stuff. And like Princeton, Yale, Harvard, people that had worked for, you know, huge companies and done amazing things. And I was this guy who came in. I remember my first day when we were doing orientation, when we all got there, and they had all of our names, all of our education history, and all of our degrees. And it was all these people with like masters and you know, masters of science with like developmental bio and all this crazy stuff, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, all this other stuff. And then it was Travis Stiles, exercise science, Willamette University, exercise phys, University of the Pacific. And I just remember being like, everyone in this room is looking at me like right now, like, why am I here? Like, what is going on? There was a lot, and I'll get more into this, but one of the lessons I learned really quick is every single other person in that room was thinking the same thing, because I might have been the best, you know, 24-year-old molecular biologist in the world, but I was looking over at the guy who had the physiology or the neuro background and being like, man, they're going to know stuff I don't know, which they would. And I remember sitting in the first year classes, and it's the first class is this whirlwind, like they go all the way from, you know, genetics all the way to phys, and they work through like the hierarchy of systems. And at any given point, somebody was the expert, raising their hand, showing off, was crushing it. And I spent the whole year not knowing anything because they started with the most micro stuff. And then at the end of the class, I was just killing it. And so I ended the class really well. People thought I was really smart, but it was just because that was my point to shine. But when I was going through all this, so I had kind of fallen in love with the idea of doing research at multiple stages of my career. I'll want to talk more about that in a bit, but this particular case, I was in the neuro kind of training course, right? And I remember there was a professor, Binhai Zhang, who studied spinal cord injury. And I don't know about you guys, but when I started out in science, I thought, you gonna keep going?
Yeah.
I was under the impression that spinal cord nerves didn't repair themselves. Like if you had damage to the brain or spinal cord, it was kind of like end, you know, ball game. You couldn't really do much about it. And I remember talking to in Binhai's class, and he was talking about how in 1982, this crazy guy, Robert Aguayo, decided, in the 80s, ethics were a lot more loose, so bear with me here. He decided he really wanted to find out how well nerves could regenerate in different areas. So we all know like people can get like fingers chopped off and sewn back on, and you can regain some function, even arms. I actually met a guy who got a motorcycle accident, got his arm ripped off at the shoulder. And I met him in the hospital, and he was going to see the physician, the same physician that I had for my bicep. And he was like, yeah, I'm coming back in. I'm 6 weeks out. They reattached my arm. He had this crazy brace on, and he was like moving his fingers. I was like, what? That's nuts. Here's a guy who had his arm ripped off, and he was getting some function back. But I had an uncle who was paralyzed before I was born who never had any improvement, none. So here's a guy. You're telling the story about in 1982, this guy's like, well, let's make sure this is the case. So what he did was, so he took nerve cells, ganglial cells, that would normally go into the sciatic nerve, isolated them, took the myelin out, and he put them into a graft. He basically took an eyeball, cut the eye off, and grafted them to the end of the optic nerve. And the other way around, he took the eyeball, grafted that onto the end of a sciatic nerve. So because in the eyeball, the nerves grow backwards. You have the retinal nerves, and they grow backward, and the ganglial cells grow down. So what he found is that from the sciatic nerves, so because he didn't get just cell bodies, right? So you t- take the sciatic nerve, cut it, and then you attach the two nerves. The nerves would eventually initially retract from being cut. So you had about, you know, a centimeter of kind of axonal sheath left. And they would grow back a little bit, but as soon as they hit that optic nerve, they stopped. So here's this nerve population that was normally considered to be extremely robust in its regenerative capacity. And on the other side, these optic nerves, which nobody in the 80s would have thought, if I chop off an eyeball and attach it to some other nerve, the nerves are going to grow. Those nerves grew all the way up the sciatic nerve, and until they synapsed, until they attached to stuff. Now, the reason that that's cool, the reason that blew my mind, is because for centuries, people had thought that humans were so complex, our nervous systems were so complex, that after a certain stage of development, brain and spinal cord nerves couldn't grow back. But here's this guy who did this crazy experiment that nobody would let him do nowadays, and he showed that it's not the nerves that fail, it's the environment, okay? So it's something intrinsic to the environment of the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord, that's blocking regeneration, not actually a failure of the nerves to grow. So that's amazing, right? Because if it's something external, and it's not just the nerves aren't good at their job, we can try to address that. We can try to figure out what the mechanism is and treat it, make the nerves grow. So, but again, I'm just a lowly, you know, muscle guy. I thought that's super cool, but I moved on with my day. A couple weeks later, I had another lecture with Katarina Kosoglou, who was an MS researcher. She was talking about how, I don't know how familiar you guys are with MS, but MS is basically neurodegenerative disease. Your immune system, which typically should not get in your brain, it does. It attacks the myelin. You get demyelinated lesions. Over time, they can't resolve themselves, and you get these, like, basically dead spots in your brain. So demyelination happens all the time, and it's your brain is really good at repairing it. So one of the things that's different about brains than bodies is the myelin coating is done by cells called oligodendrocytes, and they'll myelinate hundreds of axons. They're very dense, they're very intricate, but they're also very sensitive, so they die all the time. And your brain has this huge pool of like baby oligodendrocytes that come in and clean up the mess and fix it. So, but for some reason in MS, these chronic insults stop that from happening. Now, the crazy part is that the baby cells, they flood in. They come in, they're like, oh, the old people died. Let's go pick up the mess. And they get in there, but they don't grow up. They stay immature. And the thing that blew my mind is when she started talking about why this was, all the same kind of factors that impaired that remyelination were similar to the ones in spinal cord injury. So I was like, okay, what you're telling me is here's these like ridiculously huge problems in modern medicine, and we know what's causing it, but we haven't been able to modulate the system to make it work, to like make a change. That seems like low-hanging fruit. We should be able to fix that. But again, I'm not a neurologist or a neuroscientist. So fast forward like 4 months, and now I'm sitting in the oncology rounds, bored out of my mind, because I don't know if you knew this, but like 50% of all biomedical scientists are oncology researchers. And I'm not a real big fan of doing what other people are doing. So I wasn't really paying that much attention. And the chair of pathology was speaking. So it's a big name, makes way too much money. He's talking about his research. And he was specializing in how inflammation mediates cancer. And bored out of my mind. So at the very end, he starts talking about, he's like, and you know, so we just got this paper published. I'm really not sure what to make of it, but I got it into a really good journal, so I feel like I should talk about it. We found a new receptor for myelin debris. And people seem excited about that. We don't know why. And I was like, myelin debris is one of the main sources of these inhibitory molecules that block regeneration, both myelin growth or myelin remyelination and nerve growth. And so I was like, so myelin's and like kind of a neuro thing. Have you looked at this in neuro? And he's like, no, our lab doesn't really do neuro, so we're kind of just moving on. And I was like, well, you know that this, that, and the other is kind of a thing out there. He's like, oh, that's super cool. Moving on. So I actually went up to him after the class, and I was like, you know, I need to do another rotation. Can I just come to your lab, rotate in your lab, and play with this? I think this could be a thing. And he was like, meh, no, we do cancer. That's what we do. So I went. So, and Mark and Courtney will attest to this, I don't really take no for an answer in that kind of situation very well. So I did not start my relationship with this guy very well. But so I went to the two other faculty members that I previously talked to, and I was like, hey, here's this thing this guy found. I think it could be something. And they're like, yeah, it could be something. I was like, I really think it at least deserves a shot. Can I come and do it in your lab? They're like, well, it definitely deserves a shot, but he's kind of like our boss, or at least related to our boss, and that seems like a bad idea. that, so, but Katarina, so Katarina was a more established professor, and she was like, I'd love to take you, but I'm moving to Gladstone in San Francisco. So, unless you want to move, which is not a good idea for a PhD student, it just won't work. So, Ben and I and Katarina got together, and they decided, yeah. They might have decided that I was just annoying, they wanted to get rid of me, but they decided, yeah, this should be a thing. So they march me over to Steve's office, Steve, the chair of pathology, and they sit down with him, and they're like, hey, just take this kid. Like, we'll mentor him, we'll be on his thesis committee, but just try it. Just see what happens. Like, this is an easy thing. You identified a receptor, let's see if it does stuff. I'm like, okay. So that's how I became involved in my first neuro type of study. And so I joined this lab for like a 6-week rotation, which was all it was supposed to be. And I had never really done hardcore bench science. I mean, you guys are familiar with physiology. There's not a lot of pipetting or, you know, just so you guys know, hardcore bench science, it's like 95% of the job is pipetting really tiny volumes of liquid from one place to the other. And I had never done any of that. And so now here I am doing this really intense neuroscience experiment, but my first experiment was really simple. I learned how to isolate nerves, which was new to me, grow them, and I placed them either in a permissive environment or a inhibitory environment. The inhibitory environment was basically I just took a bunch of brain mush and laid it in there because that's the source of all the inhibitory molecules, and they didn't grow versus within the other place they did grow. And so this lab worked on this receptor. That was their thing. So they had tools to study it, and they had receptor antagonists, so something that blocked that receptor. So all I did is I took these nerve cells, sprinkled receptor antagonists on them, and lo and behold, like my very first experiment as a neuro, you know, dipping my toe in the neuro waters, I made nerves grow when they shouldn't, which makes me the most spoiled, rotten grad student in the history of man, because most grad students will spend their entire career trying to find some small piece of information that is new, not even necessarily cool or impactful, but new, that can allow them to graduate. And that's the name of the game. You have to contribute to science. And most science is, you know, a lot of times you'll discover something and it's not for, you know, multiple iterations that people realize how impactful it is. You know, very small incremental science is critical towards later innovation, but a lot of times you don't see it up front. And I gotta be honest with you, I am not patient enough for that type of science. So I went to grad school specifically because, my motivations aside, because I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to do something for humans. Like, otherwise, I could have done something that paid a little better. So, right off the bat, I knew what I was sitting on. I didn't have to kind of like worry about like trying to find my path or make my project work. This was it. This was what I needed to do. And I want to get back to that more, but I was very, very fortunate because from day one, I had more than just a goal. I had more than just, like, I need a PhD. I want a degree. I had a purpose. I found a way to make nerves grow back. I feel like I should probably explore that a little bit. I should probably see what can happen with it. So before I get back more into, thank you for putting up with that long intro. How do I push this in again?
Hit escape.
So this is my company, by the way. So fast forward many, many years. So I even after I found this discovery out, even after I'd shown this, even after like many people had gotten excited about it, at the end of my rotation, my boss was like, Vince, that's really cool. I don't want you in my lab. Which I can't really blame him. I kind of bullied my way in there. But he didn't want to do neuro. Now, to his credit, after many years, and you know, we got a lot of good credibility out of this. The university swooped in and patented the work. Which at the time sounded super cool. I had no idea what a patent was, what it meant. I just thought, oh, cool, they're going to patent my stuff. At the end of my time in that lab, though, when I started trying to look for postdocs, so you do a postdoc after your PhD, typically, and I wanted to keep working on this. Now, part of the problem was my boss was like, look, you're the only neuro person I have in the lab. When you leave, I can't work on this anymore. Like, good, you've done great stuff. I'm happy with it. But I don't have the interest or the expertise to do it. So once you leave, it's done. And I was like, well, that sucks. That doesn't seem right. So I started looking for labs to go work on this in. And what I found was it's just really hard to find another lab to take a project from a prestigious faculty member. It was really hard for me to go find a neuro lab and say, hey, I had this project in a major department chair's lab at a major university. I would like to work on it here. They're like, ooh. You know, first of all, scientists are extremely risk averse. They're not very ballsy. They do not have a lot of like go get them in them. They're very political, they're very risk averse. And so there's not a lot of like, that's really cool, I want to run with that. It's more, the first thought is, do I really want to ruffle feathers? This guy might review my grants. This guy might, you know, be reviewing my my tenure position. And so I found myself in this position where I had this great project that had gotten a lot of, you know, good press, good prestige, good publications, it had been patented, and I had no means to keep working on it, and it didn't look like anybody else would either. So I was faced with this dilemma of what do I do? So I was really blessed to have this purpose. I was really blessed. It got me through grad school. Grad school's hard. But here I am, and now that purpose is kind of being threatened. Maybe I'm not going to be able to do it anymore. So I knew nothing about business. I knew nothing about IP. I knew nothing about licensing. I knew nothing about any of this. But it came down to the point where after exploring a bunch of potential scenarios, I realized the only way I was going to be able to work on this is if I started my own company, licensed the technology from the university, which is a weird thing, by the way. I invented the technology, but I had to buy it from the university because they owned me. So, and then work on it myself. And I don't know if you guys knew this, but science is expensive. So it wasn't like I'm making an app and I could go work in my garage and live with my mom for a while and make an app and then 20 minutes later, you know, I have Snapchat or something like that, right? I'm talking about trying to make drugs that can make people walk again. So I'm like, okay, the only way I can do this is if I have my own entity. So I have to start my own company. I need millions of dollars to do this. So I had no idea to make this work. So what I did was I just started writing grants. I formed a company. I formed an LLC out of Delaware for like $100 on some weird website. And I started writing grants. And after about a year, I got one. I got a $700,000 grant. And so I'm like, oh crap, now I have to do things. What am I gonna do? And that was the birth of Noveron, my company. And it was really exciting. I was like, I have almost $1 million. I can go work on this. Everything's gonna be okay. And then sequestration hit. Remember sequestration? Probably not, huh? So sequestration was a really fun time when the US government decided that they wanted to play chicken with the economy and decided that in order to kind of like motivate politicians to be better about the budget, if they didn't negotiate a budget by a certain time, they had these like literally holding a gun to the country's head. If they didn't get a budget negotiated by a certain time, all these automatic cuts and a whole bunch of stuff would kick in. Dramatic cuts to the DOD, the military, and research. So all of a sudden, I'm getting ready to move into my new lab, hired people, and the NIH comes back and they said, oh, you know that $700,000 we gave you? Yeah, we can only afford to give you $250,000 now. And I'm like, but the grant that I gave you had $700,000 worth of proposed work. Are we chopping this up? Am I doing less? What are we doing? They're like, oh no, you have to do the same amount of work. Just go for it. So that was the beginning of the beginning of Noveron, which was the beginning of a very fun times. But let me get more into. I should probably talk about what I do a little bit. So I like talking about those stuff a little better. But so I mean, I talked a little bit about spinal cord injury and the consequences. I really like this visual. It's super overly simplified, but I love the visual. Superman, like the iconic actor of Superman, which you guys might not even know, Christopher Reeve. He's the only Superman. I don't want to hear anything about Henry Cavill or any other nonsense. This dude was the guy. I think he made like 6 Superman, of which like 2 were good, but still, it's fine. Dude gets in a horse riding accident in the 90s. Big, strapping, strong guy, paralyzed from the neck down. And to his credit, he starts the Christopher Reeve Foundation, and it becomes like the most prestigious, you know, advocate for spinal cord work in the world. They're funding tons of grants. Side note, they are no longer funding as many grants because they had a bunch of, when nonprofits have a bunch of kind of like donations, they don't want to just spend it all. So they'll like put it away, they'll invest it, and these guys unfortunately invested it all into Bernie Madoff's situation. Which, if you don't know who Bernie Madoff is, he's a terrible human being, and he had a huge Ponzi scheme. People lost billions of dollars. So Christopher Reeve Foundation was almost bankrupted by Bernie Madoff. So they're not doing as much anymore. Regardless, this guy is literally the epitome of what it is to be suffering from a spinal cord. And so paralysis, as a result of that, becomes this really obvious consequence of nerve injury. But what people don't realize is that paralysis is only one thing. So any type of damage to the brain is spinal cord. Traumatic brain injury, stroke, multiple sclerosis, you can have a whole bunch of systems, because unlike your heart, which is a pump, or your lungs, which move air, your brain does like crazy stuff. And because of that, if you get damage to certain regions, you can have different things. You can have speech impairments, memory, whatever. People that get traumatic brain injuries can smell pancakes and it smells like fire. Weird stuff happens, right? So, but fundamentally, the same underlying problems exist. Like, it's this failed regeneration that causes these deficits. So these are just more examples of the type of injuries. Now, this is where it gets to the crux of it. So I just talked about all these molecules that block regeneration. That was one of the first things that stood out to me. Now, this has been known since the 80s, so why haven't we been able to fix it, right? Well, the truth is, now, from a kind of basic standpoint, if I know X is causing Y, it has to be acting on something, right? So what is it acting on? How do I block that interaction, right? Simple, A to B, block A to B, good things happen. Well, there have been dozens of molecules identified, from myelin debris, glial scar, all this stuff that people had said, okay, this obviously stops growth. People would find individual receptors. They're like, oh, here's a new receptor. X binds to Y, things don't grow. Maybe if we block Y, we can make things grow. And over again, this didn't happen. People would genetically silence a receptor. People would develop a drug to block the receptor. Nothing would really come of it. And over time, people began to realize, well, one, there's so many of these kind of redundant systems that blocking any single one of them isn't really working. And two, there seems to be kind of redundancy also in get rid of one receptor, another receptor can do the exact same thing. But what was fascinating is none of these molecules were similar. We're not talking about like a family of proteins or even a family of receptors. Some of the receptors that were originally discovered didn't even have like signaling capabilities, which some of you, I don't, cell signaling, is that a thing? Basically, like if I'm a cell and something's happening outside of me, something needs to communicate it inside. So if a receptor only sits on the cell surface, it doesn't have the ability to communicate inside of the cell. So it needs to be transmembrane or at least associate with something transmembrane in order to kind of convey the message, right? And some of these receptors didn't have a transmembrane domain, so they couldn't communicate. So people were starting to get really confused. But the thing that was fascinating is despite all the heterogeneity, every single molecule that was identified signaled the same way to this Rho molecule. Now, this is super science and boring. I want to get back to fun stuff that's life story-wise, but this is cool. So Rho is not a bad guy. It's not a cancer molecule. It's not a mutant. It doesn't do anything wrong. Rho is one of three molecules in every one of your cells that changes the cytoskeleton to move. So like if I want to go this way, I need to kind of build this way, and then when I want to let go over here, I need to like break that down and begin moving it. So you need to have some things that build the skeleton, things that break down the skeleton, things that guide it, right? So basically, I think of it like this. You want to build a house. You have a guy that has the shovel. You have a guy that has the sledgehammer, and you have a guy that has the hammers and nails. So you have the guy that's responsible for like the foundation. You have a guy that's responsible for breaking stuff down when it needs to be broken down, and you have a guy that's responsible for putting stuff together and hammering it together, right? At any given time, every single one of these people is doing something. It's not one guy comes in and then leaves, and the other guy comes in. And if every single person had a sledgehammer, not much is going to happen, right? You're not going to build a house, right? So these are always active, always interacting, always kind of reciprocally doing things. And because of that, there's never one or the other that's like really robustly high or low. But for some reason in spinal cord injury, or in MS as well, when the system's disrupted and these molecules are floating around, they cause one of these molecules, Rho, to go through the roof, right? And then now you're taking away everybody's hammers, everyone's shovels, and it's just a sledgehammer. So nothing happens. And I want to talk, so why is this so unique to the brain? I mean, the body has myelin, the body has all this other stuff, so why is the brain like this? So the explanation I give is, what does the nerve in your body do? What? Pain, pressure, motor control, like moving a finger, pain pressure, temperature, anything else? Am I missing anything? That's it, right? What does your brain do? Speech, dreaming, imagination, language. Like there's a pretty steep change in how complex these things are, right? So I describe it this way. Let's say you're in traffic in the busiest area of downtown LA or San Francisco or Tokyo or Shanghai, and there's a massive earthquake, okay? Versus you're driving around in Caldwell, Idaho, which I've been to, it's not big, and there's a massive earthquake. Which car do you think is going to get back on the road and get to its destination faster? I mean, what do you got to do in Caldwell, Idaho? Pick up a stop sign, maybe? Maybe move a tree out of the road? Versus in Shanghai, you got bodies and fires, and it's chaos, right? And the infrastructure. And it's because you have to have so much more complexity to move the amount of people around the city that when it's broken down, the mess is so much more complicated to clean up, right? Does that make sense? That's what's different, okay? So these really fancy molecules that allow us to, at some point our bodies just decided, at some point in evolution, we're like, all right, we can do one of two things. We can be conscious and communicate with each other, or we can grow things back. I'm personally glad we made the choice we made. I don't know about you guys. But this is the consequence of that. When things are connected, when things are aligned, when things are controlled, things are awesome. Our brains are the most amazing creation in the history of Earth. But when things are bad, when things get broken down, you throw everything off and you overactivate this molecule. Now, the reason that that's cool is because you have a convergence point. The convergence point gives us an opportunity to target all these redundant systems in a way that we can fix the problem, right? So people started doing it. They started trying to block Rho, this guy. Well, what's the problem with that? Okay, so we block Rho. So we take away the guy's sledgehammer and we give the other guys back their shovel and their hammers and nails. You still need the guy with the sledgehammer. Like, going the opposite direction, it's better than nothing, but it's still causing the same type of problem. Because you're targeting something that's not bad. This is a nuanced, balanced system. Trying to make it binary one way versus the other isn't fixing the problem. So that's, I'm not going to lie to you. I think that approach can eventually pan out in clinical trials, but it has massive toxicity issues because you're shutting down pathways that you need to have. So that's the problem. So what makes me think I'm so special and I can do anything about it? So this is just showing Rho is bad. If you can make it go away, it's good. So this is where we become different. So this is all the stuff that a Rho molecule can do. And this is why targeting it ubiquitously is bad, because these are normal things. Cell motility, cytoskeletal remodeling, calcium sensitivity, cell differentiation, all sorts of things. So if you block it, yes, you can make nerves grow back, but you're also making everything else not be able to do its job. So what Noveron does is we target specifically only the inhibitory pathway. We block only the inhibitory overactivation of Rho. And the way that we do that is by targeting LRP1. And that was my fundamental discovery, okay? Or the discovery guy exploited for my career. So Steve Gonius' lab had discovered that LRP1 was a novel receptor for myoglobin. And I went in there and found out that it was mediating regenerative failure. Now, I don't know if I have it in this slide, but I can briefly. So the reason that this is unique, the whole original discovery was that LRP1 was a new receptor for myelin debris, right? Everybody follow that, right? So the problem with that was I just told you, people had found a bunch of other receptors. Blocking them didn't really do anything. So finding a new one, people didn't get really that excited about. Now, to really throw a wrench in things, when I started breaking this down and doing like biochemical studies where I was isolating pure receptor and pure proteins, I couldn't make them bind. So I've done these cell studies where I showed that blocking LRP1 did stuff, but then when I tried to prove that they bound and I started trying to like characterize how well the affinity was and whatnot, I couldn't make it happen. So I was freaking out. I was like, my whole life's a sham. What am I gonna do now? But over time, what I found was, over and over again, it didn't matter that in a purified system, I couldn't get them to interact. If I blocked it in a cell, things happened. So it turns out what actually is happening is all these different receptors can participate. So this is just a handful. P75, Lingo, TREC receptors can get in there, NGR, PIRB, all these other. There's a bunch of receptors that can come in and take the place of one another. They all, when they bind in this fashion to myelin proteins, they all form a receptor complex that requires LRP1. So the reason I couldn't get them to act in a one-to-one ratio is because it wasn't A binding to B. It was A binding to B, C, D, E. LRP's like F, I don't know. And then that was causing a translocation event. Basically, you've got, just like anything, your cell is not one big blobby body. Different components of its surface do different things. Some of it's made for scavenging. Some of it's made for cell signaling. Some of it's made for like reaching out and grabbing stuff, right? So when these receptors bind and form this complex, they're transported into the signaling domain, and that's where the Rho event happens. Without LRP1, the transfer doesn't happen, okay? And the reason that they had originally discovered that it was a receptor for and internalizing this debris was because they were seeing the same thing I was. If you block the receptor, those molecules weren't internalized into the cell. And that was their very simple conclusion. that it must be a direct receptor and internalization event. Turns out it wasn't. It was just bringing the whole complex in. Okay, and that's what makes this target unique, because it's a master mediator of all these different processes. And as such, we develop drugs to try to fix that, right? So our first drug, NOVA-117, I'm gonna be really nerdy for a second. I thought this was super cool. So typically when you have a therapeutic target, you make some chemical and it's supposed to block it, and then you screen for it, and then you do medicinal chemistry, you do all this really nerdy chemistry stuff. And I was like, you know what? The problem with every chemical-based drug, so small molecules, is that the affinities are always touchy, because they're very, very tiny. They're not biologically defined. It's very small versus macromolecules, and you're always gonna have off-target effects. And this receptor does a lot of things. I want it to be very, very specific. So I had this crazy idea. This was my idea after I stole somebody else's. So this protein is actually really big, and because it has a huge binding domain, when it's made in the cell, so it gets expressed, it gets put together, to stop it from binding things prematurely as it's getting transported to get put on the cell surface, it's expressed with what's called a chaperone protein. So this other little protein gets made with it that sticks to it so that it doesn't stick to anything else prematurely, and then when it gets transported, it lets go and it sticks to the surface. So it's like a biologically evolved, like nature did it for me, antagonist of this receptor. So I took a recombinant version of this, I took the DNA, I don't know if you guys know much about, you know, recombinant DNA technology or protein synthesis, probably not. But I basically took a virus, modified its DNA to express this protein in a special modified way so that I could make a bunch of this protein to use exogenously to block this receptor. So I could take the chaperone protein that's usually restricted in the cell that is made to block this receptor, and I'm gonna make it on my own and add it to cells so it blocks the receptor in a way that nature doesn't usually do. I thought that was cool. So that was our first drug, NOVA-117. And NOVA-117, so this is our system where we're adding myelin proteins. These are just three myelin proteins, showing that the row is up, but our drug knocked it down. That's boring. So what does that look like? So here are healthy, happy, growing nerves. And here are nerves after spinal cord injury. In this case, this is that first study I did where I put them on myelin being into the joint. And then there's them on the myelin. Now, the reason I like this is because you can see the myelin. Myelin is just a bunch of dense lipids, right? So it's like autofluorescent. It grows green. So you can see the nerves growing on the myelin. You know I'm not making it up. They're sitting on yellow stuff, right? So when you see the same nerves growing over the yellow stuff and not being inhibited, that's cool. And that's what our drug was able to do. It made nerves grow when they otherwise wouldn't. And I'll kind of fly. I'm gonna show a little bit more data because I want to keep moving. So this is showing we can do it in spinal cord injury. This is a multiple sclerosis model. Basically, not getting better, getting better. Yay, drug. But this was really cool. So this was experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis. This is a rodent model of multiple sclerosis where you trick their immune system into hating their own brain. Okay. So over time, you immunize the animals so they attack their own brain. After a couple days, they start getting sick. And then this is showing how ill they are. So in this study, we actually created, to validate the target, we created an animal that had no LRP1 in the baby oligodendrocytes, because those are the cells that are inhibited and stop it from repairing the myelin. And when those cells didn't have LRP1, they didn't get sick. That was crazy. And so now we have our first program for like 2 years was spinal cord injury. Now we're in the MS field pretty heavily as well, because that's nuts. So this is just showing that our drug works in a dose-dependent fashion, which is important if you want to convince people you have a drug. That's Steve. This is the guy that didn't want me in his lab. And these are our two other main collaborators. One guy who's not up there, Jay Lee, he's our collaborator at the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis. He's our main spinal cord collaborator. Great guy. The only reason he's not up here is because none of our IP is he an inventor on. All three of these guys are inventors on our IP. IP is intellectual property, patents. That's me. That's my co-founder, Taylor. So, blah, blah, blah. So, okay. So that's what we do. That's what my company does. But, and I'll be honest, like, it's surreal for me to be up here because I was not a special student. Like, I love making fun of Mark for this, but because like when I was applying to grad schools, he was like, you might want to look at some less good schools. I don't know how this is going to go for you. And then when I got into UCSD, he was like, really? You got in there? And that's, I mean, and that's not, I mean, I kind of felt the same way. I was like, yeah, go me. I tricked them. I don't know how. And so I, and the reason I bring that up is because I want to emphasize, I'm not anything special. I don't really have, my biggest weapon is I'm super obnoxious. Like, if I want to do something, I don't take no for an answer. I will push forward and go crazy with it. And that is a very useful skill in science because a lot of people aren't that way. So you can get pretty far with that. But I also had this luxury of purpose. You know, I might have mentioned it earlier, but I got into research. I originally came to Pacific because I wanted to boost up my resume because I wanted to go to med school. I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. I love exercise physiology. I love exercise science. I love kinesiology. I love biomechanics. I love athletic training. I love all of it. I love looking at sports injuries, muscle. It's still more fun for me than neuro. And so, the natural kind of conclusion of that was going to be ortho. I just thought it would be super fun. But as I was leaving Lamet, a fraternity brother of mine was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and I've had a decent amount of experience with physicians, and physicians, especially the higher up you go, you know, neurosurgeons, neurologists, cardiovascular surgeons, they have an arrogance, they have a God complex, and I don't say that in a negative way. I don't say that to rip on them. You have to, when you walk into rooms every day, playing God, changing lives, you have to have this feeling of, I can do this, I am this guy. And so I'm not trying to take away from that. What I'm trying to bring up is that in contrast to that, when I was dealing with Talon, my friend, and I was in the room with some of the best neurologists in California, they would come into the room shuffling their feet, staring at the ground, saying the bare minimum, because they couldn't do anything. You couldn't do anything. There's nothing you can do for ALS. If you have Lou Gehrig's disease, you wait until you're sick enough to need a mechanical ventilator, until you're sick enough to need a feeding tube, and then you die. That's it. We can't make you better. We can't slow your symptoms. We can't do any of that. We basically keep you alive until you no longer want to be alive anymore, or until we can't keep you alive anymore. And the really horrible part about it is your brain stays fine the whole time. It's all peripheral nerves. It's all motor neurons. You become trapped in your own body. And so I remember being like, I don't like being helpless. I don't like feeling like I can't do something. I really don't like understanding stuff. I hate not knowing answers. And so while I was here, working with Mark, really exposing me to research, which I'd never done before, I realized not only did I really like the puzzle of research, like weirdly liked it, but research gives you an opportunity to address problems nobody else is addressing, or at least address problems that nobody else has addressed yet. It gives you the opportunity where even if it's only this big, you have the ability to make a difference in something that nobody else can. Like, a surgeon might be able to fix 100 people every day, but he's never gonna help my buddy Callan, ever. Callan's gone, sucks, but even if he would've lived 100 more years, there's nothing that he could've done to make a difference. Every single time I publish a paper, every single time you guys publish a paper, you are adding something to the world that nobody else has ever added. And that was fascinating to me. It restored that ability for me to think I can do something. And that's the difference. Now, here's the problem. I started a company. I need you to close your eyes and imagine this situation. At the end of my graduate school, I was like, I have to start a company to cure paralysis. I'm gonna run around the world and tell people I'm starting a company because I think I can make people walk again. I don't know about you guys, but I felt like an idiot saying that. Like, who am I? Like, I'm just a guy. Like, that makes no sense. And the reason I bring that up is because going back to that grad school experience I was telling you about, when I was surrounded by a bunch of other really smart kids, that feeling of imposter syndrome is something that really stuck with me. You always feel like you're not the person. You always feel like somebody else is gonna be able to pull it off. The people who act like they're the person are faking it. I know that because I do it every day. But here's the deal. Fake it till you make it is a real thing. Okay? Having a purpose makes that fake it till you make it become real. And I bring that up because there are two types of successful people in this world. There are people that go into the world saying, I want to do this for me. I want to make this money. I want to get this house. I want to do these things. And you can be very successful doing that most of the time following an existing path. A lucrative path, and I'm not trying to take anything away from that. But if you have ambition and aspirations, if you want to feel like you've accomplished something, I really only seen one type of person do that. And it's the type of person that goes out and says, I want to do something. I want to make something happen. And that motivation combined with a really strong persistence and unwillingness to just like give up and say no, those are the people, whether or not they're extremely talented or not, that end up doing crazy things, that end up changing the world, changing the way things work. And I feel weird being up here. There's not people walking around out there that wouldn't walk without me yet. I mean, my accomplishments right now are largely, I have some patents. Other people recognize my work. Other people are working on some of my stuff now, and that's awesome. Honestly, like if I fail, the fact that other people are working on my stuff now will make me feel better. But my accomplishments are still largely kind of symbolic. And I have to kind of make myself sometimes, like in this room right now, I have to make myself sit back and be like, I can enjoy this. Because otherwise I just feel super, I feel like this is ridiculous. I feel like any one of you could be up here talking just as much as me. The only difference is I'm like way older than you guys. No, the reason I feel like this is important to tell you guys is because I want you to know this so that you don't ever feel like you have to hold yourself back because you're not the person. That's dumb. And you need to surround yourself with people like Courtney and like Mark and like Peg. People that will tell you you're doing a good job. People that will tell you you can do this. You're doing well. This is awesome. Like that will tell you you can. That will tell you that you can. The people that tell you that you can't, you need to stop listening to. They are no longer, their opinion is void. Okay? Because it's not productive. I mean, unless you're like, I can fly. Then saying no is probably a good thing. And, you know, so, like, the reason I really was happy and excited to talk to students today, the reason why I didn't really care if there's, politicians, president, whatever, in here, is because those people, I'm just going to be very honest, those people, I mean, they're there, for one, they've done their thing, they're successful, and they've largely done it based on a predetermined path. They've walked there. They've done their job, and that is wonderful. I'm not trying to take anything away from that. And any one of you that does that, that is awesome. But there are people in this room who have higher aspirations, who are getting that paycheck, who are getting that fancy thing on the wall, whatever, is not going to be enough. And that's the people that I really want to make sure that hear this, is because you need to make sure that no matter what happens, you don't let the status quo or the struggle get to you. This has been really hard. I mean, I've raised $2 million just in cash, much more money in collaborations and people putting resources into my company. That sounds awesome. Science is so expensive. I've struggled. There's been times where if you guys read that bio, like, so I was recently recognized as one of the 6 trailblazing young scientists under 40 by Johnson & Johnson, worldwide. That was awesome. And I was like, there's no way I deserve that, no way. But it was awesome, and I literally like touted the crap out of it. I was tweeting, I was putting flyers. But I felt super self-conscious because at that time that article came out, I had just sold my car, I'd given up my apartment, and I was living with an amazing old man that was letting me stay at his house because he needed somebody to stay there sometimes. And the reason I did that was because the NIH was having some budget concerns. Our next grant might not come in. And I had 3 employees that I didn't want to let go. And I didn't want to give up my lab. My lab's awesome, and if you have giving it up and trying to find a new one would have been painful. So I sold my car, gave up my apartment, took on another job so that I could pay my employees and keep working. Now, there's people in this room right now that are like, oh, that's so nice. Oh, look at him, he's taking care of his employees. No, don't do that. It was a horrible idea. But at the end of the day, I did it because that's what you have to do. And that made me really subconscious about how people could look at me and give me these accolades when that was the situation. Now, again, so that's what I had to do. I don't regret it, but in retrospect, I want to point out another kind of life lesson that's a little bit more pragmatic, a little less like, Don't ever put yourself in a situation, if you're the heart and soul of something, don't ever put yourself in a situation that you're drawn away. I thought I was sacrificing for the cause. I thought I was taking care of my employees. Anything that pulls me away from Novaron is a bad idea. Me having to go get another job really set us back. And I've learned now, I always paid my employees more. In my mind, I was like, if my company does anything, I'm going to make a lot of money. Like, that's not why I do this. But it's like the least amount of money, if my company does something, the least amount of money that I'll make is more money than I know what to do with, like, 50 times over. And so I always was always like, I should pay my employees. Like, they're the ones sacrificing. They're the one investing. I shouldn't get as much. And because of that, when times got tough, I didn't have the buffer to go through a tough time. So the reason I say that is, if you want to take risks, you got to give yourself a buffer. You got to give yourself the ability to take risks. Put yourself in a situation where if you need to throw yourself into something, you can do it without becoming homeless. You can do it without having to sacrifice your health. You can do it without ending up, you know, crippled financially because of it for a long time. You know, so if you have the opportunity to take risks and do things, do it. But make sure you take care of yourself and your core team first. Because you might love the other people that you're working with. You might never want to abandon certain things. You might not want to do X, Y, and Z. But you're the person. And that's a lesson I've had to learn the hard way. And I have a hard time saying those things because I feel like that's arrogant and I'm not special, once again. But the truth is, I invented this stuff. If I'm not there, it's not happening. So that's another little bit more piece of pragmatic advice that I think is important to hear. Because if I did inspire any of you to do stupid stuff, then I want you to do it without making yourself, you know, in a breadline eventually at some point. So, yeah, so that's pretty much all I had to say. If you guys have any questions.
So, those of you that don't know, last fall we inducted Dr. Baltazar into the Hall of Fame. So, Travis is our second inductee into the Hall of Fame, and I appreciate him and Alex coming out. So, just two things before you go. If you're in 135, I've got a study guide for you. If you want to hang out for a few minutes and chat with Travis, you can do that as well. So, thank you all for coming, and thanks to Travis. I'm going to give Benson a pile of these over here, and Taylor a pile of these. And then just grab one.